From WFAE and Discovery Place, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was Jane Goodall's childhood dream to travel to Africa and work with wildlife. Unlike many of us, she achieved that dream at the age of 23. And unlike many of us, she went on to distinguish herself in her field. It is because of Jane Goodall that we now know that chimpanzees have distinct personalities. Where we once thought that only humans could fashion tools to help them in their work, we now know that chimps do too. Aside from her research, Dr. Goodall runs an orphanage for nearly 200 chimpanzees whose mothers were killed by poachers. She also campaigns tirelessly for wildlife preservation. She has employed missionary-like efforts to save Africa's chimps from extinction. Another part of the campaign is an effort to inspire others to join her in this work. One of the ways that happens is through her talks to heads of state, other government officials, to foundations, and to school children. One new way she'll be able to reach people is through the new IMAX film, Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees, which is opening in Charlotte here at Discovery Place on Friday. That would be tomorrow. And that is why Jane Goodall is in town, and as an extra special treat, she joins us for the hour. What a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's good to be here and meet you as well.
Nice to have you with us. We are also joined here at Discovery Place by about 200 or so people, many of them young people from Harris Road Middle School, Myers Park High School, Garinger High School, Randolph Middle School, Cannon School, Crestdale Middle School, East Lincoln High School, Providence Spring Elementary, Irwin Avenue, Open IB, and UNC Charlotte. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's like being in a classroom. You didn't stand when you said that. That's all right. As we go through the program, I'm sure you'll have questions of your own. You're certainly welcome to join us by telephone, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, or charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we've set up two microphones here at Discovery Place for you to ask questions as well. In retrospect, what has been the most important part of your work, the discoveries that you've made with chimpanzees, or this effort to save them from extinction?
Well, I think one led to the other. You know, initially it was the discoveries that captured people's imagination and helped people to realize that there isn't a sharp line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's a blurry line, and it gives us a little humility. You know, once you're prepared to believe that we're not the only beings on this planet with personalities, minds, and above all, feelings, then it does give you a new understanding of our relationship with the rest of the natural world. And that's why it's now so desperately important to try and use this understanding to save what's left, because we are destroying the world very fast.
You discovered this. I mean, you're the one that is responsible, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, for developing this understanding that we're not the only species and that the animals aren't necessarily put here for our use. That's a time-tested theory that you've kind of put pinpricks in, correct?
Yeah, I and many others subsequently, okay. You know, but of course it's basically been Western science and to some extent Western religion that drew this sharp line. The indigenous people don't have it, and many of the Eastern religions also.
Has it been a hard sell to the West?
It's taken a long time, and there are still pockets of resistance, and they're particularly with people who are exploiting animals, like people doing invasive medical research, mm-hmm. the intensive farming. These people, they don't want to think that animals have minds and feelings. I mean, it makes it very hard for them to do their job, so they put blinkers on.
You've been fascinated by animals since you were a little girl. I think I read that your parents gave you a little stuffed chimpanzee. This is not the one, is it?
No, this is okay. A monkey. See, there's a story. I'm carrying this little mascot, which we'll talk about later.
Okay, but your parents gave you one as a child, and it kind of fascinated you, and you've wanted to go into the wild and study animals for your whole life, correct?
Yes, and that was, I did have Jubilee, and I did carry him everywhere, but the thing which really got me to my dream of Africa was two books. First of all, the Dr. Dolittle books.
Really?
And then, absolutely. You know, there's one.
Can you talk to the animals?
Well, to some extent, yes. But that's the movie. These, I'm talking about the books.
Books, what a concept.
Okay. there's one where Dr. Dolittle takes the circus animals and back to Africa. And, you know, this was very magical to me. And then Tarzan. The Tarzan books, not Johnny Weissmuller, not the movies, but the books, really the books. And In fact, when my mother saved up, because we didn't have any money when I was growing up, she saved up to take me to one of the early Tarzan movies. Mm-hmm. And I burst into tears. She had to take me out. She said, "Whatever's the matter?" I said, "Well, that wasn't Tarzan." Because I had my imaginary Tarzan with whom I was in love and terribly jealous of his wretched Jane.
But that's... Because you are Jane, aren't you?
I thought she was a wimp and I'd have been a much better mate for Tarzan.
I think you're probably right.
Oh, I was right.
Oh, my God.
You know, I was about 10 at that time, 10 or 11. And, of course, when I said that when I grew up I wanted to go to Africa, live with animals and write books, everybody laughed and said, "Oh, Jane, get real. You know, no money. How do you get there? It's the dark continent." We sort of thought about poisoned arrows and drum beats in the sinister dark jungles, you know. But also all those amazing animals. And it was my mother. She was the most, I think, important influence in my life, because she used to say, "Jane, if you really want something, you work hard, you take advantage of opportunity, and you never give up. You find a way."
And one of those ways, if I'm right about this, is that your mother had to go with you on that first trip because they didn't want you to be there. You were 23, correct?
When I was 23, I saved up money. I didn't go to university because we couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mom said, "Well, if you take a secretarial course, you can get a job anywhere." So when I was 23, I got an invitation from a school friend who invited me to Kenya because her parents had moved there. So I quit. I had an amazing job in London with documentary films, but I quit it because it was expensive in London, and worked as a waitress and saved up wages, tips, wages, tips, wages, tips, until I had enough for return fare by boat, which was the cheapest. So off I went at 23, you know, bye-bye family, friends, country. And that was where I met this amazing late Louis Leakey. He was a paleontologist, anthropologist, searching for fossils of human remains. And he it was who gave me this amazing opportunity to study the chimps.
Why did he do that? You had no university education. You didn't have a PhD at the time. Paleontology was not your field. You really were in love with animals and not the bones of dead animals. Why did he want you as part of his team?
He was fascinated by animals. He was curator of the Natural History Museum at that time. And when I went to see him because somebody said I should, he asked me all these questions. He took me around. He asked question after question. And because I'd gone on reading about animals in Africa, I could answer a lot of them. So he gave me a job working for him. And then he realized, you know, I didn't care about boyfriends and parties and hair and clothes and the things that lots of young girls do. And so he asked if I'd like to go and try and learn about the chimps. Well, of course, I was a girl. I didn't have a degree. It was crazy. How would he get the money? It took him a year to find a wealthy American businessman. I had money for only 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then the British authorities in what was then Tanganyika, Tanzania today, a girl alone in the bush, this is ridiculous, impossible. In fact, people thought Lewis was amoral. And but in the end, they said, well, if she brings a companion. So that was when my amazing mother volunteered to come for 4 months. And, you know, the rest is history.
In the bush. She must have really enjoyed that.
She never had a very strong stomach. She was sick a lot of the time.
Uh-huh.
She was amazing. She worked hour after hour in the heat. It's very hot there. And she took lots of simple medicines, not that she was a doctor or a nurse. And she treated people by, you know, spending hours with them, aspirins and saline drips, you know, salt and water, all the old remedies that her brother, who was a doctor, had told her about. She made amazing cures. She was known as a white witch doctor.
When you started, is it safe to say, on that first trip into the jungle, is it safe to say that there really was no technique, no tools, per se, to study what you went in there to study, and you had no training in this? So how did you know where to begin?
Well, all my life, you know, as a child, I had gone out into the little places around where I lived and sat for hours watching. I would wait for hours, a whole morning perhaps, to see how a bird fed her babies or made her nest. I would watch the spiders and how they carried their eggs on their backs and then their babies on their backs. And, you know, so I just developed my own way of being out there, and I just took all that with me into the forest. And the worst problem was that the chimps always ran away.
Well, it took you a long time to get their confidence. Why is that? When you first got there, they wanted nothing to do with you. They'd run away. You couldn't study them. You stuck around for a long time. I guess they became used to you. But why were they afraid of humans? Is that part of their natural defense? Or had humans been predators and so they knew better than to be near us?
They weren't really persecuted in that area. There was no hunting of chimpanzees. The people didn't eat them. But they're naturally conservative, and I was a very peculiar creature. They'd never seen a white ape before, and that's, of course, what I was. And we are apes, and I was white, and they'd never seen anything like it. So they just were very cautious. But it has to have been something to do with bad experiences with humans, I think, because just 2 months ago, I had this wonderful opportunity to go into the heart of darkest Africa. It's an unlogged, unlived-in part of the Congo Basin. And there, chimpanzees, gorillas, the animals had never learned to fear man. And they're just curious. They don't come close, but they don't run away.
Weren't you afraid of them?
There were moments as they began to lose their fear, they became rather belligerent and treated me a bit as if I was a predator. And that's, you get these spine-chilling screams, and the big males with their hair out, and they look huge because they're up above you in the trees, and they shake the branches like this, and sometimes they'll charge along the ground and slap at the ground and throw rocks. That was very scary.
And they're much stronger. Even these little small chimps are much stronger, aren't they not, than humans?
Yeah, they're not so little. They stand...
How big are they?
They stand 4 and a bit feet when they're upright. But they are, I mean, a big male will be maybe 10 times stronger than me.
Do you remember the first contact that you had with one where they actually trusted you enough to get close enough to touch them?
Oh, I remember it as though it was yesterday. But not touching, but just I remember the time when instead of running away, they just looked at me and carried on grooming each other.
Really?
Yeah. It was magic. It was absolutely magic.
Do you remember the first discovery that really opened your eyes, that you understood I'm onto something here?
Well, yeah, because see, the biggest problem as they ran away and ran away and ran away is that I knew there was only money for 6 months, and I knew that if I didn't see something exciting in that time, no, everyone would say, well, we told you so, this is ridiculous, and I would have let Lewis down as well as coming to the end of the study. But one day when I was walking through the forest, through the vegetation, I saw this dark shape hunched over a termite mound, and I could see that he was using blades of grass to fish for termites and stripping twigs.
Tools. And heretofore, humans thought that they had they'd cornered the market on being the tool makers and
That's
the tool
right.
users.
We were known as man the tool maker when I was growing up.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more from Jane Goodall, who's at Discovery Place to open the IMAX film, Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzee. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Our guest today, the legendary Jane Goodall. She's in town to open the IMAX film at Discovery Place, Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzee. She also has a new book coming out later this fall, if it's not already out, called The 10 Trusts, What We Must Do to Care for the Animals We Love. And we'll talk about that as well. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can't use email today, I'm sorry to say, but you can call us, 704-926-WFAE, or join us at the microphones we have set up here at the Discovery Place. You have said, Jane Goodall, that part of your dream was to become as close to talking to animals as you could. You talk to them?
Well, we know now the whole complex communication pattern of the chimps. We don't use that in the field. We really want to try and, you know, get an insight into their world, the way they live within their world. We want to be as unobtrusive as possible. But we are looking after these orphans whose mothers have basically been shot for food. And there we can use these communication patterns, and we do. It makes them, you know, we have to give them a lot of love and attention to make up for the trauma of having their mother shot from under them.
And those patterns would be things like what?
Well, they have a very, the most insignificant thing really is their touch and gesture, and that is the same as ours: kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting on the back, swaggering, shaking the fist, all of this in the same context that we do it.
Really?
They also have a rich repertoire of calls, and I mean, is laughing. And
that's laughing?
It's laughing.
That's not what I thought it was, but... give me another example.
I'm keeping away from the loud ones because I don't want to blow the
mic. No, it's okay. You can be loud.
Well,
we'll can just... she be loud? Okay. These are kids. They love loud stuff. I mean.
Well, the distance call. You know, if I'm greeting everyone listening, I mean, you are far away, and so I would... That's...
Now, what does that mean?
That's really, I'm here, I'm me, who's out there, good morning.
Really?
Yes.
Do they have, as you go from one part of Africa to another, do they have different calls, different gestures, different, for lack of a better word, dialects?
They have the same kind of inbuilt patterns, but they tend to use them in slightly different ways. And where we really see so clearly that they do have their own form of primitive culture, that's behavior that's passed from one generation to the next through observation and imitation, tool using. Everywhere we find different objects used in different ways, and sometimes that's because of the environment, but very often it's just, you know, one chimp at some point has a great idea and it's useful, so the others gradually imitate it.
You know, we think of thinking beings, sentient beings, as being aware of their own mortality, as mourning those, loving people, loving, well, we human beings love each other, or profess to, and we build relationships with others. And chimpanzees do the same thing. Are they monogamous? Do they love each other? Do they mourn for each other when one passes away?
They're not monogamous, so a female may be mated by most or all of the males in her community, although there may be a special relationship. But between mothers and their growing offspring, between brothers and sisters, you get long-term affectionate supportive bonds that can last right through a life of anything up to 60 years.
How do they demonstrate that affection?
Well, they do, like us, grieve, mourn. They may even die, like a 5, 6, 7-year-old child. On losing the mother may actually show signs of clinical depression, and the immune system weakens, they get sick and die.
If a mother of a young chimp dies, does the rest of the, well, what do you call them? They're not a herd.
Community.
Does the rest of the community take over? Does somebody else, does another female figure take over?
If there's a brother or sister, an older brother or sister, they take over. Even if the little one is still dependent on milk, which is when they're under 3, anything up to 3, the older child will try to care for them. It's really sad to watch because the little one just gets weaker and weaker and the elder brother or sister is carrying him or her around, and it's very sad. But only once have we seen a non-relative adopt an infant at Gombe.
I don't mean to get morose here, but what do they do with the bodies?
They carry them around for 3 or 4 days, sometimes much longer. And then eventually they leave them for a bit longer and a bit longer. And it's a very, very sad thing to watch. So, you know, you do get these wonderful relationships, that relationships between brothers helps one or other of the brothers to get to the top-ranking position. The relationship between a mother and her offspring, if she's high-ranking and assertive, her kids have a much better chance of doing well.
So there's a hierarchy.
Yeah, so there's a hierarchy. And what we see with chimps, which is disturbing but fascinating, is that they have this intensely loving, compassionate, caring side, but they also have a dark and brutal side. It makes them even more like us.
I want to come back to that, and I want to come back to Fifi, who is one of the I think it's the last remaining chimp of the original chimpanzees that you got to know, who's still alive. And whose sons are, am I right about this, fighting for control of the community at the moment?
They have been fighting, and first of all, her eldest son, Freud, reigned as top-ranking male for, I think it was 5 or 6 years. And then he got very sick, So his young brother, who had been really intimidated by his elder brother, now got his own back, and Frodo is now the top-ranking male.
Frodo.
Frodo is the, he's very, very larger than life on this new IMAX film.
I want to come back to that in just a couple of seconds. We have some questions here on the floor and a few questions from our listeners as well. Let me begin here at Discovery Place with you. Hi.
Hi, my name is Elena from Randolph Middle School in Charlotte, and I wanted to know, what thing have you learned through working with chimpanzees that you think most applies to daily life?
The thing that most surprised me.
The most applies to daily life, is that what you said?
Yes, most applies to daily life.
Well, you know, this, the overall thing that it teaches us more respect for animals, we've learned that. But if we're thinking directly of what we've learned from the chimps, I think the tremendous importance of early experience. We know that young chimps with the right kind of mother, the right kind of family, do well. Those chimps, those infants who have rather harsh, uncaring mothers, grow up to be tense and relaxed and not relaxed in their relations with others.
Can you explain the difference? In human society, we're seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
But you have to factor in economic factors, you have to factor in educational factors, two things that the chimps do not have to deal with. Can you explain it in their society?
Well, in their society, it very often does depend how they were mothered themselves as to how they will mother. But the good mother is protective but not overprotective. She's supportive. That's perhaps the most important, so that if her kid gets into a scrap with someone else, she's there for the child. But also affectionate and playful. These are the hallmarks of good maternal behavior. And then there are females who are much less affectionate, much tougher. And then they don't make such good mothers. But you must have a mother who can discipline the child. That's terribly important.
I guess their currency, for lack of a better term, would be food. Mm-hmm. Do they share? Or is food my food and your food is your food?
Well, it depends what it is. They are hunters. They hunt various kinds of animals. And the generous ones will share the food. The mothers will usually share with their young, but some mothers won't. And so it's a question of personality. Some are generous and some are not. But there's a begging gesture, holding out the hand with the palm up and whimpering. And sometimes a generous individual actually break off a piece of food and hand it over.
Wow.
At other times they just let the beggar either take a piece with their mouth or with their hands. And sometimes they attack them and say, no, you can't have any of this, you know.
Interesting. Let's go over to you, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tom Hongqiang. I'm from Randolph Middle School. Dr. Goodall, what have you learned from the chimps that applies to yourself and what have you become ill that's not scientific?
Well, it's what we've already said, really. It's just the way I look out at the world around me and just feel a part of this amazing animal kingdom and not separated from it. So that, and if you're not being scientific, you look at everything with wonder, with awe. It's just so amazing, this miracle of life. And I think it's not so much the chimps, it's having been spending so many long years out in the forest, just with myself and nature, that's made me very, very grateful to have had that experience.
You, I'll take some more questions in just a couple of seconds. You mentioned the dark side of chimpanzee behavior. They conduct a kind of warfare, don't they?
Yeah, it was the males quite regularly patrol the boundary of their territory, and at Gombe that's about 15 to 25 square kilometers, depending on the relationship with neighboring ones. But on these patrols, if they come across lone individuals from a neighboring social group, they will chase, and if they're lucky enough or unlucky for the victim, they will subject that individual to very brutal attacks. And when our main study community divided, then the males of the larger portion systematically went deep into the heartland of what the splinter group had taken for its own and annihilated the whole community one after the other, except for the adolescent females who they tried to gather in.
First of all, why did they split? And secondly, how do you explain that behavior?
Well, I think they split because the community just started to grow too big and they couldn't cope. There were too many adult males. and the hierarchy sort of broke down because, you know, they make alliances, and it was just chaos all the time with so many adult males. And so they just divided automatically into two groups of friendly males.
We have lots of people lining up to ask questions, so let's go back to the microphones up there. Hi.
Hi, I'm Arielle from Randolph Middle School, and I was wondering what part of the chimpanzee studies that you did when you were younger, about 20, in your 20s, what do you think changed your views of the human world and how the animal and human societies differ? What do you think changed your views the most?
Well, let me tell you, I'll have to come at this from a different direction. When I, Louis Leakey finally said to me, Jane, you have to get a degree. I'm not going to be here always to get money for you, because the National Geographic came in after that first 6 months because of the tool using. But he said, you know, I won't be around. So he said, we don't have time for you to mess about with a BA. You've got to go straight for a PhD. So I arrived at Cambridge University very naive, very excited. I was looking forward to this, you know, science thing. And when I got there, there was basically hostility. I shouldn't have named the chimps or described their personalities or talked about their minds or certainly their emotions. That was all not scientific. And I should have been intimidated because these were very erudite professors. But all through my childhood, I'd had this wonderful teacher, and that was my dog, Rusty. And I knew that animals had personalities, minds, and feelings. Of course we should give them names and not numbers. And so I was, I suppose, very cheeky, and I stuck to my guns. And, you know, gradually things have changed. So I never had this, you know, scientists must be cold and objective kind of approach, never.
Plus, I mean, scientists go in with a theory and try to prove the theory. You didn't go in with any preconceived notions. Did they frown on that?
At that time, no, and the study of animal behavior was too relatively new, and we were still at the stage of let's learn everything we can. But I was, you know, when I went back for my second stint in the field, I was told that I should now choose a particular aspect of behavior and concentrate on it. And luckily, again, I said, I can't. I'm just beginning to vaguely understand what this all means. I can't suddenly start concentrating on, you know, what foods do they eat and how do they eat them. I must go on learning about everything.
Wow. We're going to take some more questions from the floor in a second. Let me take a few phone calls from our listeners here on WFAE. Let me go to Amy in Charlotte. Amy, you're on with Dr. Jane Goodall. Hi.
Jane, I just wanted to tell you, your initial story in National Geographic is pretty much true. It started my life going towards the way it was. You, Leakey, and Dr. Stowe were the three main influences from childhood on.
Well, thank you.
Your work and how you reported it and everything all the way here has really inspired a lot of us to go out and explore and learn new things and travel to other countries, and I just want to say thank you.
Well, that's really nice, because I think, you know, a lot of people say this kind of thing, and it's wonderful to think that there are people around the world who are doing what they do in the way they do it because they read those Geographic articles and saw the documentaries. The chimps have contributed so much because it was the people were fascinated, I know by me because I was a girl, but the chimps were so fascinating.
They were fascinated by you too, I think. I mean, I remember this. I mean, you were an amazing figure to most of us because you were unique. There are no other Jane Goodalls. Certainly were none at the time. I know that you have been replaced by another woman in the jungle as you go out and do these appearances and campaign for wildlife conservation. But at the time, you were it.
Yeah, I was it. But now there's a whole team now, a wonderful team of people working at Gombe. And, you know, a lot of them are Tanzanians. And the European ones come and go, and the Tanzanians stay, and it's exciting. But what amazes me is if I go to somewhere like South Korea, people come up in the street and say, you're Jane Goodall, and they say, how's Fifi? Would they have said, how was number three?
No.
I doubt it.
Amy, thank you very much for your call. Let me go to another phone call here to Patty in Matthews. Patty, welcome to WFAE.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering, Jane, if you have any opinion about the theory that humans had an aquatic or
better explain some of the differences between us and some of the other savanna animals. And also, I'd like you to please comment about your activism and why you have become much more of an activist.
Okay, we have about 40 seconds left.
Well, I became an activist because I realized that in the wild, the chimpanzees are vanishing, and in captivity, they are often very, very cruelly and wrongfully treated.
Which we'll talk about at some length in the next segment. Have you heard about her aquatic ape theory?
Yes, I can't see that could have been.
But you do believe in the potential existence of Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
But there's nothing. There's no bodies. There's nothing to prove that. But you think it could be true.
I do think it could be true. And they found a hair 2 weeks ago that cannot be identified as any known animal.
It's mine. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. On WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. We're live from Discovery Place with Dr. Jane Goodall. How many of you, before we go back to the floor for questions, how many of you are members of Dr. Goodall's Roots and Shoots program? Not everyone.
You'll be.
They will. Talk briefly about Roots and Shoots. That's a brand new program, isn't it?
Roots and Shoots began in 91 in Tanzania.
Oh my gosh, it's 10
years. It began because, you know, now I travel 300 days a year around the world, and I met so many young people who felt so in despair about what we're doing to the environment, the poison that we're throwing out, the, you know, the social problems, the injustice, the war, that they were losing hope. And Roots and Shoots is a program for hope. It's symbolic. Roots make a firm foundation. Shoots seem tiny, but to reach the light, they can break through brick walls. And if we see the brick walls as all these horrible problems that we've inflicted on this poor old planet, then you see hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can make the world better. So what began as 18 high school students in Tanzania is now about 4,000 active groups in 60 countries. And a group can be a whole school, and it's preschool right through university. Mm-hmm. It's even appearing in prisons and senior citizen complexes.
Wow.
And every group tackles three different kinds of projects to make the world a better place, one for their own human community, one for animals, including domestic animals, and one for the environment. And the most important message, every individual makes a difference every day. And I'll bet you everybody in this room wants to help make the world a better place. Therefore, yes? And it's very, very easy to join. It's the education program of the Jane Goodall Institute. And just all you have to look up is janegoodall.org. And
easy
then you find out how to join Roots and Shoots and join this growing band of young people around the world who want a world of peace, a world where we live in harmony with nature, and a world where we get rid of all this social injustice.
We have a growing band of young people standing behind microphones wanting to ask questions, so let's get to one of them right now.
Thank you. My name is Amanda Shinte from Myers Park High School, and we are likewise working on an environmental and educational initiative at tolerancematters.org. We're trying to bring global issues to the attention of students and our local community. What difficulties have you encountered as an activist introducing global ideas to Westerners with an isolated perspective, and what advice can you give us to encourage others to think outside of themselves to the global perspective?
Well, I think Roots and Shoots does it perfectly because you tackle your local problems and you see that you're making a difference in your local problems, and then you find there are other students the same age in other parts of the world who are tackling the same kind of problems and also making a difference, and that makes you start looking out. We also partner groups with with similar age kids in wherever they want in other parts of the world, like China or Africa or Europe. And many of our Roots and Shoots groups in affluent schools are actually helping schools who they don't even have desks. It's so hard for American kids to understand, but these children, they have to walk maybe 7 miles to school. They have no proper food. There's no fresh water. There's no hygienic latrines. There are no desks. There may be maybe 4 books in the whole school. And this is school. This is all they have. So it's very possible for schools over here to raise the money so that we can give them some books, some pencils, even some desks.
Okay, thank you for your question. Over here.
Hi, my name is Charlotte Middleton, and I'm so honored to be here. And my question is, in Zimbabwe, hunting is promoted as a way of animal management, and I just wanted you to comment on that.
Comment on what?
In Zimbabwe, hunting is promoted as a form of animal management, and she wanted you to comment on that.
Well, hunting is proposed as used as a form of animal management everywhere, certainly all throughout the United States, Canada, Europe. We have people buying hunting licenses. And, you know, it is true that as we destroy more and more environment, it can be that there isn't enough environment left for animals like deer. And they do have to be, we have to do something, otherwise they die of starvation. But I think the sad thing here is, why do people want to go and kill them? I can understand that maybe we might have to, but I cannot understand, it's very sad to me that people find this sport, that they find it exciting. I mean, you can go and hunt an animal with a camera, that's much more exciting and much more sporting.
All right, over here.
As a prominent woman in the field of science, what's the best advice that you feel you can give to prospective young female scientists?
Well, the most important advice is that there's now a lot of competition to get into these kinds of fields, and you have to really want to do it, and then the best advice I have is what my mother gave me, that you have to work hard, you have to take advantage of opportunity, and you must never give up. Also, join Roots and Shoots. I'm serious about that. It's helping so many young people around the world.
Okay, over here, sir.
My name is Frank Montalini from Garrett High School. I'm an admirer of your work, Mrs. Goodall. And what I'd like to know is if your work with the Chimp Grove is very rewarding.
It was absolutely rewarding. It was my childhood dream come true. And to be out there with them once they came to accept me, to be in the amazing position of being the first person to look into a magic world, to sort of, you know, open that door, helped by David Greybeard, my first chimpanzee friend, it was real magic.
You know, you've spent, it occurs to me, most of your adult life in the forest, in the jungle, fairly alone. Many times, aside from the animals that you were trying to study. What's that like,
living there? Well, I think, that was what I always wanted. So I love being alone, and that doesn't mean that I don't like people. So I know there's some field biologists they're not very good in social situations. But I think I find people, I know we're animals too, and I like studying people as well as animals. But to be alone in the forest, to me, is... It's very close to some great spiritual power, at least that's how I feel.
But it's not just chimpanzees in that forest. It's snakes and poisonous spiders and lions and tigers and bears, oh my. So how did you get beyond the fear? How did you protect yourself? How did you know what you could and couldn't do, what your boundaries were, and where it was safe to go and not safe to go, etc.?
I think it was just common sense and, all the reading I'd done and the feelings I had. And I guess I was a bit,
Were you lucky?
I was lucky. There were leopards there. But no, basically, if you don't hurt animals and you move around carefully, you don't get hurt. I've never been stung by a scorpion. I've never been bitten by a snake. I mean, I think it's to do with the way you move about.
And but how did you know that?
I just did.
Have others that you've known in the field been hurt?
Yes.
They didn't know that.
I guess.
Just checking. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Sam Perkins from Myers Park High School. And during your field studies, did you have to use food provisions in order to habituate the chimpanzees? And if so, how do you feel it, as well as maybe your presence at all, affected their behavior?
Great question.
Well, we did use bananas, and that was when my ex-husband came to start filming. He really needed chimps in one place to film them. We did definitely affect their behaviors, no question about that. But as I've always been interested in the difference between individuals, all the chimps in our community were similarly affected, so that didn't affect that part of what I was interested in. It gave us an amazing opportunity to get to know things that we might never otherwise have known. We don't feed them anymore, and it was in a way like a sort of unplanned field experiment.
Since he asked such a great question, let me ask a really stupid one. Obviously, these chimps don't know what a camera is, so they can't play to the camera, but have they seen photographs of themselves? And do they recognize it? How do they play to the photographs?
Well, this has been done quite a lot with captive chimpanzees. And like totally naive humans, at first they don't know, but if you give them opportunity to spend time with photographs and they have mirrors, then they get to know that, you know, that this picture is actually me. And one of our most intelligent chimps ever, Fifi's elder brother, Figgin. I had one of these little things where you put a slide and press a button, and it's to view slides. And I had a picture of his mother, Flo, and I turned it towards him. He was just sitting there. And he stared and stared and stared at it, and then he looked at his mother. He looked back at the picture, and he looked at his mother, and he made a grin of fear. It was quite extraordinary. Figgin, yes.
Wow. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Eric Tita from the Cannon School, and I was wondering if the apes would make series of noises without waiting for a response, or in other terms, sing.
They have a call which they make at night when everything's gone well in their world and they're lying in their nests or sitting beside them, because they make these sleeping platforms every night. And it seems to be like, I'm here, all's well with the world, you know, the old town crier going around. It's like the pantoute I gave earlier, and it's ooh, 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 ooh. It's the closest to singing they do.
Hi, I'm Cindy Cameron from I'm Cindy from Providence Spring Elementary, and is there any chimp that first trusted you, or did they kind of accept you as a community, not one by one?
No, the first one was David Graybeard that I mentioned, and then I think Flo was about the next with her family. And it's true that I knew Fifi in 1961. She was about 2 years old then, and she's still alive now. And, you know, I go back and look into her eyes, and I know that there are certain experiences that she and I share. And the other was, Goblin was born in 1964. He's in this IMAX as well. And but the others have gone.
What's the life expectancy for chimps?
Well, in captivity, they can live to be about 60. In the wild, probably not. Don't often live more than 50, because, you know, their teeth get worn and they don't have such a consistently adequate diet and things like that.
And the biggest danger to them in the wild, obviously, is man. But from what source? Deforestation or what?
Yeah, it depends which country. In Tanzania, absolutely, it's deforestation. But in the Congo Basin, which is the last stronghold of chimps, gorillas, bonobos, and so many other amazing forest animals, it's what's known as the bushmeat trade, and that is commercial hunting of wild animals for food. So it's different from subsistence hunting. People have lived, you know, on the land for hundreds and hundreds of years in perfect harmony with the forest. But now logging companies have made roads deep into the heart of the forest. And for the first time, the hunters can go in from the towns, they camp there, they shoot everything, smoke it, load it onto the trucks, sell it in the towns. And the logging camps, maybe 2,000 people who weren't in the forest before, the pygmy people are given money and ammunition, and they shoot for them. So when the logging camp goes, the animals have gone, because it's absolutely not sustainable, any of this. And there's no animals left, and the pygmies have lost their culture, and there's nothing for them at all.
And nothing for them to eat.
And nothing for them to eat.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Dr. Jane. My name is Anne Kinsella, and I attend Myers Park High School. In your orphanage for chimpanzees, are the chimps different in the other regions in Africa? Are they building relationships with one another, and do they treat each other as brothers and sisters?
That's a real good question. Luckily, we have some of our orphans who were captured later when they're about 3 or 4 years old, and they have already acquired a lot of the wisdom of their community, and they pass that on, and they form wonderful relationships, these orphans. Our biggest sanctuary is in Congo Brazzaville, and there we have 105 chimpanzee orphans, some of whom are now full grown. And it's a nightmare for us because we can't put them back in the forest because the wild chimps would probably kill them. The forest is dwindling, or they've come to trust people, so they'd wander into a village and hurt someone or be hurt. So we have to care for them, and it's very expensive. So we have a chimpanzee guardian program, and you know there are a lot of roots and shoots groups are helping us to care. We also have orphanages in Kenya and in Uganda. In fact, the Uganda one's in the IMAX film.
I know you've spent most of your life talking about and studying chimpanzees, but they're baboons in the IMAX film. Compare the intelligence of chimpanzees to monkeys, to apes, the larger apes, to baboons, to gorillas.
Well, I don't really like comparing the intelligence, but if we compare like the genetic structure or the structure of the brain, chimpanzees are more like us than they are like gorillas. Gorillas are much more like us than orangutans. Orangutans are more like us than monkeys. Huh. So that's from the genetic.
And we share about 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees.
Yeah,
we
do.
Very quickly, I have like a minute left here, but go ahead.
My name is Rachel Myrick, and I'm from Randolph Middle. I wanted to know, what do you think is the most important lesson you've learned throughout the course of your lifetime?
Hmm. Well, I think the most important lesson is that it's very important how we interact with each other. Chimps are wonderful at resolving conflict. They don't like leaving a situation when they have bad relations with the others. You know, outside this building, there is this amazing bronze collection called The Gathering by Bart Walter. And that really, when you look at those chimpanzees reaching out to each other and reaching out to us, it's like a bridge. And we just have to be more close.
The statues of the chimpanzees that she's talking about were installed yesterday. I thought it was members of the city council, but now I've been wised up. Dr. Jane Goodall, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate your time and for coming to Charlotte as well and for your work.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our program is produced by Wendy Bratz. Thanks today to WFAE engineer Joby Sprinkle, Jim Hoffman, and Chad Currier from Discovery Place, technical assistance from Discovery Place as well, and thanks to Tim Ross and Joe Jones and Tina Simmons and Brian Talbot back at our studios. I'm Mike Collins.